highest level of radioactivity in drinking water ever found. And that came from seepage from a military radioactive waste disposal depot nearby. So it's not theoretical. The Shippingport, Pennsylvania plant had an accident a little while ago, and there's a lot of shoddy practices going on in that plant that will soon be made public. Right outside of Detroit, they built an experimental breeder reactor. The breeder reactor is the second generation nuclear reactor. That's even more catastrophic. But they built an experimental breeder. It had an accident inside the plant in 1967. They couldn't fix it. It disrupted the plant for several years. Now they have closed it down forever. One of the engineers at the time of the accident was heard to say, "My God, we almost lost Detroit." Now, if you ask yourself, how can the government have permitted this kind of technology? It's unbelievable that these risks would occur with all the stringency. Well, there are two answers to that. One is the safety standards are very tough, but very tough isn't enough when you're dealing with the most potentially catastrophic technology we've ever had outside of warfare in our history. In other words, 99.9% isn't enough. All you need are three or four major accidents of that level, and you can see what the consequences are now and in the future. And secondly, they always felt, that is the government and the utilities, they always felt that they'd come up with the answers. For example, they installed emergency core cooling systems in these plants and never tested them. And then they found out they don't work. And the only tests they conducted were computer simulation tests. And when they finally reduced the test to small-scale testing, 6 out of 6 of the tests failed. So the government had to send out derating notices to a number of the plants, lower your power output for precautionary purposes. A few weeks ago, they decided to send out a warning to have these plants test the hydraulic shock absorbers for earthquake resistance. A number of these plants tested them. They were deficient. So they had to improve them. Well, these are the kinds of things that are happening. Suffice it to say that all over the country, the most militant civilian groups are developing against the perpetuation of nuclear power. And if these groups continue to grow, continue to get the facts, and to continue to give people the facts, we won't have any more nuclear fission plants built after another 5 years, by which time there'll be about 100 in operation. But at least there will be a cessation. No society should rely on that kind of technology unless its very survival was at stake. And we don't need nuclear fission power for our survival. There are alternatives from energy conservation to pollution control for fossil fuels to development of solar and geothermal energy, which is really the energy sources of the future. The sun will be the energy source of the future, not just radiant energy, but possibly thermal energy from differential heat levels in the ocean. Even wind energy is coming in for serious consideration. Suffice it to say that we've got a great deal more oil in this country than is being publicized. And I'm not just speaking about the oil shale, which is enough oil to supply the country for 200 years. I'm also speaking about the oil that has not been taken from existing wells, because up until now, they have not had the technology, or it has not been economic per barrel, to take this oil. But now it is, because of the increased price of oil and improved technology. And the estimates I've heard are anywhere from 100 to 300 billion barrels of oil. And since we use 15 million barrels of oil a day, you can imagine how long 100 to 300 billion barrels of oil will take us. There's a lot more oil in this country, quite a part of offshore drilling, than we are being given information upon. The oil industry thrives on presumed scarcity because it can jack up the price and twist Washington's arm even more when there is a scarcity type of situation. That's why the government's effort, the Federal Trade Commission to be exact, effort to break up the oil industry and make it more competitive, separate the refining from the retailing and the like, is so important. Otherwise, this industry is going to take over Washington entirely. It already has a Department of the Interior, which is like an accounts receivable for the oil industry. And it's had great influence in the White House under all presidents and in Congress, but it has to be curbed. Too much is at stake. If we want to ask ourselves, why haven't we put more money into solar energy? The answer is because the oil industry doesn't have title to the sun. Solar energy has received a mere $10 million, $10 to $15 million at the most, of federal funds since World War II, compared to $30 billion in nuclear fission and untold hundreds of millions for coal and oil research. Now, that does not happen by mistake. It happens because the vested economic interests control fossil fuels. That's what they want to sell at higher and higher prices. The sun belongs to everybody. And besides, how do you deplete the sun? You have a sun depletion allowance? Pretty tough. So they want to go the fossil fuel route, but that doesn't mean that that's going to be our long-range answer. There's an obscure bill that just passed the Senate Commerce Committee on its way to the Senate floor, sponsored by Senator Tunney of California. That bill says that the government should spend $250 million to develop alternative automobile engines that would consume fuel more efficiently and pollute drastically less. And that's where we're at. The auto industry has had 21 years of notice to clean up its engine, and all it's been doing has been cleaning up the motorist's pocketbook. 21 years since the California Institute of Technology scientist Harley Hagenschmidt connected up automobile exhaust with photochemical smog. 21 years of dragging their feet, phonying around, and increasing the cost of maintenance of these tricky little indescript systems for years. For some 20 years, they were conspiring to restrain the development and marketing of these pollution control systems. The Justice Department sued them in 1969 and then settled out of court 9 months later under highly mysterious circumstances, where the auto industry came in and signed a little consent decree, which is otherwise translated as saying, although we never admit we did it in the past, we agree never to do it again in the future. That is, conspire to restrain the development and marketing of these systems. But perhaps the acid test challenging the auto industry's protestations in Detroit came from Honda, and little Toyo Kogyo, two little Japanese companies who've been producing cars for about 5 or 6 years and who submitted their engines to the Environmental Protection Agency in Washington. And lo and behold, they met the 75 standards last year at a time when the auto companies, GM, Ford, Chrysler, 50 times bigger, said that they couldn't meet the standards. Now, how could little Honda meet the standards but not big GM? How? GM has more money, more scientists. They've been in the business for 70 years. How? To rub it in, Honda took its stratified charge engine, put it in a big four-door Chevrolet, and that passed the 75 standards. So now GM had to license the technology from Honda in order to give them a little credibility and a little more time to delay. That's the difference between a company that wants to compete and a company that's already in the saddle and doesn't want to change. Now, let me just add, in terms of what the students can do about all this, a few words dealing with the student public interest research group idea, some of whom might have been in touch with students here at Dutchess. The idea is really simple. There are now 18 student public interest research groups in the United States, 18 in 18 states, starting in Oregon in 1970-71, spreading to Minnesota, and now Massachusetts, Vermont, New Jersey, Michigan, Iowa, St. Louis, Austin, Texas, and New York State. The idea was simple. Students would petition on each college campus their board of trustees or board of education. They would petition to ask for the approval of an added $3 to $4 assessment per student. The students would get all this money together under an elected student board of directors, incorporate a public interest research group, and hire their own attorneys, scientists, organizers, writers, health professionals, whatever skills they want, to further the causes that students are interested in improving their society, whether it involves cleaning up government, pollution control, poverty, mass transit, consumer protection, housing, whatever the case may be that the students are particularly interested in. Well, in the states where these groups have been established for over 2 years, such as Minnesota and Oregon, these groups are household words. Their reports, their lobbying, their successful lawsuits, their mobilizing community effort has been on television, radio, in the press. You go to Minnesota and you say, have you ever heard of MPIRG, which stands for the Minnesota Student Public Interest Research Group? And they say, of course. Legislators ask the students' full-time staff for help in drafting legislation or bringing together evidence. You now have a growing student PIRG here in New York. Needless to say, the New York State Public Interest Research Group could be the most powerful in the United States outside of California, if only because of the number of students here in New York State. But thus far, the New York Student PIRG has established offices in Syracuse, Albany, and New York. It is building up its staff of lawyers and organizers and scientists. Schools such as RPI and Queens and a number of others have already petitioned successfully and achieved the approval of their trustees for contributing to the funding of the PIRGs. The PIRG is able to recruit very, very high caliber young talent for a fraction of the salary that these lawyers and other professionals can earn in law firms or in other employment situations. The importance about all this in educational terms is quite clear. In Oregon, for instance, 50 courses, with the approval of the faculty, 50 courses already in Oregon provide course credit for students working on Oregon PIRG efforts. There are now internships being offered by the New York State PIRG. You might have seen some of the signs up on your bulletin board. I'm sure that many faculty throughout New York State will see that working on the New York State PIRG projects by students is a demanding intellectual task. It's rigorous, and it combines the motivating factors of being a challenge to the analytic skills of the student as well as to the value systems of the students. And if you can challenge students in those two areas at the same time, you've, I think, gone a long way to overcome the principal obstacle to student learning, which is boredom. Absolute widespread endemic boredom that you see and you have seen year in and year out on college campuses. Why students should be bored? They are in the most idealistic period of their lives. They can pioneer, create, challenge, question, innovate. They've got more elective time for thinking than probably they'll ever have. And they are as free as they'll ever be. Students don't believe that. Wait until you graduate and see. And so this is the time to think about what your real career choices are. Whether you want to just sell your skills to the company that hires you and leave your value systems back at home, or whether you're going to be able to generate an independent citizen spirit on the job if you see something is wrong on the job, or whether, even better, you're going to help the student PIRGs to build new careers of full-time citizens where they can offer job opportunities for people coming out of the schools in New York who want to apply their skills and apply their value systems at the same time on the job. For instance, instead of being, let's say, a health professional working in a hospital, which is good, that's needed, you're a health professional working in a hospital with a civic sense of strategy that knows how to improve that hospital rather than just meekly taking orders, even though you think these orders are harmful to the welfare of the patient. Or even, perhaps, more prominently, you would be a health professional working outside the hospital as part of a full-time citizen group trying to make hospitals and doctors and the medical care system more efficient, of a higher quality, and more distributive to the poor. And that's what I mean by full-time citizen effort, where you are outside these institutions working on institutions of government and private institutions to try to reform or change or transmute them into superior performance. To give you an illustration briefly of what the New York Student Perg has been doing, they're working in the area of cable TV. Community colleges here and all over the country have a marvelous opportunity to hook into a cable TV system and to provide their students with the opportunity to develop programming for local cable TV transmission. And furthermore, even to hook up this kind of transmission with other areas in community colleges. As is true here at Dutchess, you've got marvelous equipment for this. You can correlate it with educational courses for the students that are already existing, and it's a marvelous opportunity. The New York Student Perg is going to try to provide the information for the students so they can join with the faculty and administrators and move more quickly in these areas around the state. The New York State Student Perg is also going to investigate the New York legislature. That's going to be a lot of fun. Our legislators in Albany operate pretty much out of the limelight, except for lobbyists who know what they're doing. But how about the folks back home? What do they know their legislator is doing or not doing or being beholden to? The extent of absenteeism, whether he's doing his job in terms of the needs of the local district, and what have you. The PERG will develop individual profiles on each of these state legislators, accurate, objective, analytical, in order to develop a citizen action body around the state. The student PERG will undoubtedly work in the area of toy safety, as PERGs have around the country. They'll work in the area of property tax reform, in the area of child abuse, in the area of consumer complaint centers, setting them up with heavy volunteer input, in reforming small claims courts, so if people have small grievances, they can go to these small claims courts and have them remedied quickly and efficiently without losing time from work. They'll work in the area of New York subway change. How's that for a challenge? In the area of occupational health and safety, in the area of studying some of these city and state regulatory agencies that get very, very little attention, as well as the more obvious areas of consumer protection, environmental protection, equal rights projects, emergency medical care, and so forth. These are some of the issues that student interns can work on, by the way, with the New York PERG. Now, I emphasize this burgeoning idea of student involvement, both because it can expose the student to terrifically inspired educational achievement, as well as citizenship training, which is really what perhaps the ultimate purpose of education should be, whether it's general, liberal, or specialized. And if any of the students are interested in learning more about what the New York State PERG is doing, after the discussion period, you can come up here and we can answer some of your questions in more detail. Donald Ross, who's the head of the New York State PERG, is here today, and he'll be able to answer your questions as well. If there's one thing that educational progress has got to pay attention to, and that's how do you motivate students, how do you get over their boredom, how do you get them to use, instead of 10 or 15% of their potential, at least 50 or 60% of their potential. We think we have unlocked some of the secrets of motivating students, at least for the students who come down to Washington and work with us in the summer on the government regulatory agencies that are not being responsive to the public interest. The students are given pressure, deadlines, responsibility, and a subject area that interests them. If the area doesn't interest them, they don't work on it. And they come through with flying colors, and they leave in September with almost an awesome development of themselves in a 8 to 11 or 12 week period. The same type of experience can occur right here in New York State with this type of idea of the student PERG. It's remarkable to see that these petitions on campus get anywhere from 55 to 95% of the students signing, asking for the assessment of $3 or $4 or $5 per year to get a student PERG underway. In Vermont, the students set up the student PERG in less than 3 months on a $6 per student assessment, and it's now the most powerful civic interest group in Vermont without any doubt. They made, for example, a survey of dental care in Vermont and found out that it was atrocious, that half of the children under 15 had never seen a dentist, that 10% of the people in Vermont had no teeth. And they got through the Vermont legislature a rural child dental care, comprehensive dental care bill, which is a model for the rest of the nation. In Massachusetts, the student PIRG researchers and lawyers challenged successfully a injudicious highway development in Western Mass. They challenged a utility rate increase. In Minnesota, they won a case against illegal timbering on federal forest lands. In Oregon, they uncovered a massive credit discrimination against women by banks, which led to remedial legislation. They worked on employment discrimination in Minneapolis. They worked on mass transit planning in Portland, Oregon. In Texas, the students got a bill through the legislature eliminating the prohibition of pharmacies advertising their drugs by price, which the pharmacies had gotten legislated to begin with, so they didn't have to compete against one another by price. And this will lead to reduced price level for these kinds of prescribed drugs. And so it goes. Just scratching the surface of the kind of civic action and constructive democratic assertion that students working with faculty, if they so wish, can aspire to. The students were given the vote at 18, and it shows that they haven't really started to use it because they're trying to, in effect, vote in a vacuum. They're voting for personalities. They're voting for Tweedledum and Tweedledee. But if they start voting on the basis of issues which politicians have to take a clear stand on, like the political reform package that the New York State PIRG is promoting now, election campaign reform, freedom of information, conflicts of interest disclosure, and so forth, then the students and citizens around the state will feel that they do count, they can register in areas that really matter, and they can begin commanding their own destiny in the process of self-government, which is what the Founding Fathers were talking about if we listen clearly to their words and to their intent. Thank you very much.
Can I have your attention for just a minute? Those people who are interested in either talking to Mr. Don Ross or to Mr. Nader, if they would please come up, go upstairs to the dance studio. We have a room reserved upstairs. For those of you who don't know how to get there, go out this door here, and it's on the right. You'll see stairs, and it's upstairs. Okay, so anybody who is interested in talking to either Mr. Ross...
We have some questions.
Yes.
I'll repeat the questions so everybody can hear in the back, if you will.
If anybody has a question, if you can raise your hand, I'll come as far as I can to you,
yes.
But you'll have to come the rest of the way to me.
You said there were groups that were taking action against the nuclear fission plants, and you didn't name any specific groups, but what are they?
Yes. If you want information... on the nuclear reactor issue, write to Professor Henry Kendall, K-E-N-D-A-L-L, Department of Physics, MIT, Cambridge, Massachusetts. And they will send you a list of groups that they know of in that's closer to the New York area that you can get in touch with. Any questions? Any questions?
Okay, hang on. Could you stand and come? Could you come to me?
Okay. In most communities, you know, the children, I find that when I'm driving along in my car, they have to ride alongside the road. It's very dangerous. What is the best way to build, because even I would like to, if I have to go to the store or anything, that they're not too far away, instead of getting killed around the corner, you know, along a road, the best way to build these bicycle paths so that people can actually commute from one place to another.
That's a good point. You know, the way our new residential areas are being built in the country with no sidewalks, and you have to expose yourself to hazards if you want to walk or take a bicycle.
Right.
And in Washington, where there is a strong bicycle lobby in the District of Columbia, they are pushing for completely separate bicycle paths, not just on the side of the road, but in a few feet, so that you completely separate the traffic. That can be done only in some areas, as you know. It's pretty tough to do it when you get inside the city. But that is what has to be done. You cannot mix you cannot mix automobile and bicycle and foot traffic. It's too dangerous for the latter people. Now, if you want to write to the District of Columbia Bicycle Association, I don't know what the address is, but you can probably get it through the telephone operator. They'll send you all their materials in this area, and suggest what can be done. But if you don't reach them, write to Commissioner Nicholas Johnson, Federal Communications Commission, Washington, D.C., and he'll get you the information.
Mr. Nader,
yes.
You've been talking about something to do with the politics of students, and as an astute observer of the Washington scene, it would be a shame to have you leave us without having some observations on what's happening in Washington. Would you like a specific question, or would you want to just generally comment on what we might anticipate in the very near future?
Well, I think what we might anticipate is a change of presidents. There is a most Americans get one or two bites of the apple. 2,000 or 3,000 bites is enough for the president, I would think. The problem of Watergate-related criminality, and it goes all the way from sabotaging elections to burglarizing to violating campaign laws to illegally impounding funds to cover-ups and obstructing of justice and illegally firing the special prosecutor Cox. Misusing the FBI, IRS, CIA, harass people. Illegal wiretapping, forging public opinion in terms of forging telegrams and the like, and then announcing that the people support the president's policies. There's just no end. If you put it all together over the last 18 months, if you just list them, 1, 2, 3, 4, you'll run up 100 pages of a bill of particulars. And the question basically is, at what point does a president and his associates step down? Now, if we had a parliamentary democracy like Canada or England, the prime minister and his cabinet would have been out of office in 2 days after the first Watergate-type disclosures. Now, our system is much more rigid. The only way to do that is through the impeachment process by the Constitution, whereupon the House makes the charge and the Senate tries the president, presided over by the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. It's a very lengthy and arduous process. But it seems increasingly clear in Washington that the shattering of any confidence in the administration by the public and by even more traditional special interest groups, as well as the paralysis of many government programs as they await an unreceived request from the White House to do X and Y, that all that is leading to what many think will be the resignation of the president before any final impeachment efforts come to a conclusion. Now, the last week, with the sudden disclosure about the two tapes, which happened to be the two more important tapes, by sheer coincidence, that has led to demands for resignation from sources that must know that it's going to happen, or that the trend is certainly going to be irreversible. When Time Magazine, the Detroit News, and the Denver Post, many traditionally Republican organizations, news organizations, start making that call, Joe Alsop, William F. Buckley, in effect, leaning that way, then the main right-to-center support of the president begins to crumble. And the moment that Mr. Ford becomes confirmed as vice president, then there will be even less reason for the Republicans to continue to be neutral or to support Mr. Nixon, and they will likely move away from him in significant numbers. I think it'll probably take about 3 months and it'll be President Gerald Ford.
Mr. Nader, there are three specific problems in this area. Rather, across the river in Highland, a nuclear plant is being planned. And just recently, off Sheaf Road in the town of Poughkeepsie, I believe it's called the New York State Power Commission, which I believe is a conglomerate of all the utility companies in conjunction with the state, have erected towers for testing of pollution so they can base their future plans on building more power units. Number two, Stewart Jetport threatens to be a jumbo jetport, which can threaten the environment. How can these be stopped or worked against now by the citizens of the area?
There are only two tools. One is litigation to get you time, even if you can't win. And second is a political organizational response, where you basically get the elected leaders in the community at the local, state, and national level to choose between the expressed desire of the public in the area or the particular interests in airport and nuclear fission development. I don't know much at all about the airport, the jetport that's proposed, but nuclear fission plants are the same everywhere, and that is purely going to be a combined strategy of litigation and political pressure. Now, one approach, for instance, is the following. The Atomic Energy Commission revoked the permit to build a nuclear power plant 15 miles from Philadelphia on the grounds that it was too close to a major population center. So now the company's going to build it about 35 miles away. Now, here's where the Atomic Energy Commission gets itself into a bind. Because they are allowing a nuclear power plant to be built about 15 miles away from Cedar Rapids, Iowa, which is about 100,000 people. So what is the government doing? They're saying that 100,000 people aren't as important as a million people? That's a pretty tough proposition to uphold in that context. And so you might start with, depending on how far the construction has gone, you might start with the siting issue itself. And then move on to all the other issues that are delineated quite clearly by the Union of Concerned Scientists at the Department of Physics at MIT, which you can write to.
Mr. Nader, being a person who's been bumped from scheduled airline flights, I personally want to thank you for your action against Allegheny Airlines, and I'd like to know if your organization has had any feedback about, you know, how that movement against the policy of overbooking is progressing.
Well, we filed suit against Allegheny because they had overbooked, and we found out that they systematically and consciously overbook. They bumped 16,000 people in the last 3 years. And, you know, if you lose your, if you have a confirmed reservation on a plane, you go to the gate and they say, sorry, we don't have any seats for you. You can't say, oh, well, what's the difference? I'll just take a bus for 700 miles. You know, and when you get a situation where there aren't many alternatives or you got to wait another 6 hours for a particular flight, schedules can be pretty seriously upset. There is a solution. The airlines say, well, what do we do with the no-shows? Well, Eastern Airlines has pretty much solved the problem. They have this leisure-type class where when the plane is filled up and you call and you say, I want a reservation, they say, sorry, the plane is filled up, but if you come out the airport, we'll give you a leisure-type standing. And if you don't get the seat, if the seat doesn't open up, you get the next one that comes along free. The important thing about it is that one airline has done it. Why shouldn't all the airlines do it? And I think that Allegheny now, because it's under that judgment, that court judgment, although it's appealing it, that we have obtained, that they'll think twice about overbooking consciously. But the real solution is to get the Civil Aeronautics Board to prohibit it. And that's even harder than getting the airlines, because the Civil Aeronautics Board is the airlines. Can't tell the difference between the two.
Mr. Nader, previously you were speaking about the dangers of nuclear fission as an energy source, and you commented that in your opinion that solar energy is the energy of the future. I was wondering if you could tell me your views on the nuclear fusion type of...
Yes. Well, that is considered, if it's perfected, that is considered much, much safer than nuclear fission. But although there have been some recent breakthroughs, scientific breakthroughs, nobody ventures to predict that fusion will be available before the year 2000. So while I suppose continued work should go on, we do have to choose, if there are scarce federal funding, whether we want to put it in fusion or whether we want to put it in solar and geothermal and other forms of energy. But there's no question, I think, in anybody's mind, that fusion is a far more safe and inexhaustible method than the nuclear fusion, short of the breeder. And the breeder is considered more dangerous.
Yes, Mr. Nader, I'd like to get back to the Stewart Airport situation. And as you know, the MTA has had the problem of mass transit, of trying to get the people from Newburgh to New York. Now, if Stewart does become our fourth jetport, how would you recommend that we handle this mass transit?
I really can't comment because I don't know the details of the situation. My comments would be far too general to be of any use. You'd have to know a lot about the overlapping jurisdictions, the time scale, what kind of public demand there is. No, I mean, it's just too detailed to comment on. I don't have the details.
I believe that's it, sir.
Thank you very much. Anybody who's interested in the room afterwards, thank you.